Am I still making up bullshit things?
Is that, what do you does mean? That mean can we hear you?
yeah, basically.
Then yes, you are still making up bullshit things.
Excellent.
"Why, O people of the Noldor," he cried, "why should we longer serve the jealous Valar, who cannot keep us nor even their own realm secure from their enemy? And though he be now their foe, are not they and he of one kin? Vengeance calls me hence, but even were it otherwise, I would not dwell longer in the same land with the kin of my father's slayer and of the thief of my treasure. Yet I am not the only valiant in this valiant people. And have ye not all lost your king? And what else have ye not lost, cooped here in a narrow land between the mountains and the sea? Here once was light, that the Valar begrudged to Middle-earth, but now dark levels all. Shall we mourn here deedless forever? A shadow folk, mist-haunting, dropping vain tears in the thankless sea? Or shall we return to our home? In Quivienen sweet ran the waters under unclouded stars, and wide lands lay about, where a free people might walk. There they lie still, and await us who in our folly forsook them. Come away. Let the cowards keep the city."
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. This is going to be our third meeting of the Silmarillion crew for our Silmarillion reread. We have already covered the beginning of the book up through chapter 6, so today we will be discussing chapter 7 through 12 of the Quintus Silmarillion, which is of the Silmarils and the unrest of the Noldor through the coming of men. My name is Greg. I'm Claudius the Fool on the forums, and I am joined by three other vassals, maybe four at some point. But do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
This is Brett, White Raven on the forums.
This is Shane, East Texas Direwolf on the forums.
This is Matt Varley on the forums.
And we might be joined by Barrick at some point. If not, Matt has agreed to take over to bear his burdens for this episode. All right, so we're going to start off with Chapter 7, which is of the Silmarils and the Unrest of the Noldor. And I believe that Shane is going to be recapping this one for us.
That's correct. Of the Silmarils and the Unrest of the Noldor, or when shit starts to go down. Let's see. The elves and Fëanor are in their full might. Fëanor makes the Silmarils. Perhaps he had some forethought of what was to come, it's suggested, but not known. There were three great jewels in form. Their substance is unknown. There's a sequence here, some sentences in here that I wasn't going to include in my recap, but I just think they're interesting. It's kind of suggested, this might be something from the end of the book because I haven't read far ahead, but it says that Fëanor is waiting and that he's going to return, sort of like at the end of the world.
Well, there's that debate as to, do the elves come back? Is it like strict reincarnation? Do they have a choice, or do they all come back, or do only some of them come back? But that's sort of like the mystery of, they go to the halls of Mandos and they wait there, and then they're, I think we're meant to believe that they do come back, they're reborn at some point, if I'm not mistaken.
"But not until the end, when Fëanor shall return, who perished ere the sun was made, and sits now in the halls of awaiting, and comes no more among his kin. Not until the sun passes and the moon falls shall it be known for what substance they were made." It does say, "who perished ere the sun was made," so I guess that means he perished? He did die?
He dies before the sun is created.
Hold on.
We haven't read that yet.
But that's what it just said.
No, I know. It's the weird writing style.
Yeah, but he didn't.
Not yet.
But the sun hasn't been created yet.
Just remember, we're supposed to be elves reading this in like a library sometime in the Third Age, let's say, on Tol Ur-Sayah, so we know what happened. We're just reading a story, so you're allowed to not know that what's happened yet. You're a newborn elfling, so you're reading this for the first time.
There's quite a bit of the time where he foreshadows something that's to come in the future.
And then Mando's butts in with his little spoilers.
But those are kind of like part of the story they're telling, but there's times where he like says something from the future before it actually happens. He even does it in Lord of the Rings sometimes.
But we read in these chapters when the sun and the moon are made and Fëanor's still alive. That's what I'm getting at.
I know. Take it up with Christopher.
Okay, there we go.
Some all inconsistencies. Right, let's go.
All right. "The Silmarils looked like diamonds. No violence in Arda could harm them. But the crystals were just vessels for the light of the trees of Valinor. Even in darkness, the Silmarils shone like stars, but they also reflected light brilliantly. Varda hallowed the Silmarils so that no mortal, unclean, or evil hands could touch them without being scorched and withered. Mandors foretold the fate of Arda. Earth, sea, and air were locked within them. The heart of Feanor was bound to them. Melkor lusted for the Silmarils and schemed to get them. And he schemed and schemed and schemed. I just love the way Tolkien describes the way he sowed lies and discontent. Long was he at work, and slow at first, and barren was his labor. But he that sows lies in the end shall not lack of a harvest, and soon he may rest from toil indeed, while others reap and sow in his stead.
Just to be clear, you're talking about Melkor here, not Feanor.
Correct.
Okay. I didn't know if we said that yet.
Yeah, we're talking about Melkor. Melkor sows dissent. He suggested that the Valar were jealous of what Eldar might do and were subjugating them. Melkor reveals to the Eldar that men will come, and the Valar wanted the Eldar, or he suggests to the
Noldor,
that the Valar wanted the Eldar out of the way so that they could influence men who were weaker than the firstborn, and that the men would inherit Middle-earth. So peace in Valinor was poisoned. Many Eldor forgot that their knowledge came from the Valar. Many, including Feanor, began to want to live without the Valar looking over their shoulders. Feanor wore the Silmarils on occasion, such at feasts, but he usually kept them guarded and began to hoard them and only showed them to his father and sons. Feanor forgot that he did not create the light within them. Melkor creates dissent between Feanor and Fingolfin. Melkor saw that Tom was right, and he showed the Noldor how to forge weapons. They made sword, axes, and spears, and then shields, which they displayed openly. The weapons they kept guarded and hidden. The houses of Feanor and Fingolfin each thought that they were the only ones that made weapons. Feanor made a secret forge that Melkor didn't even know about, and made fell swords for himself and his sons and great helms. So, Melkor with lies brought about the end of the high days of Valinor. Feanor began to speak openly against the Valar. Finwë, who is much more of a classic elf from the Lord of the Rings that we are familiar with, sits around not doing anything. Finwë calls for his lords. Fingolfin gets there first and asks his father to do something about Feanor. Feanor enters fully armed and armored and hears Fingolfin. He draws his sword on his brother and orders him away. Fingolfin? Well, it gets worse. Fingolfin leaves, but Fëanor follows him and puts his sword to his breast and threatens him some more, like a douche move.
Can I read his quote, that he's his little badass words to sure. Fingolfin? See, half-brother, this is sharper than thy tongue. Try but once more to usurp my place and the love of my father, and maybe it rid the Noldor of one who seeks to be master of thralls. Yeah, he's got trust issues.
It's such a dick move, because Fingolfin's just like, whatever, yeah, that's fine. I'm not trying to take over your place, dude. And he's just like, no, I will kill you.
Tells him to leave. He leaves, and he follows him. Hey, I'm not done yet.
This, like, I always like, Fingolfin is always one of the elves that I like throughout the entire story. And even, this is like the first time we kind of see him as a character, not just like a named character. And it's like, yeah, right off the bat, it was just, why is he being like this?
But yeah, I remember you saying on the last podcast that you don't necessarily agree with everything he does, but you understand it. And as we go along, I'm thinking this dude is just, he's like a bad guy. He's totally out of line.
Feanor, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I understand it because he created something that no one, well, we will get to when he actually kind of really starts to snowball, but I understand it from a creator.
Spoiler alert on my chapter.
Yeah, okay. We'll save it.
No, he's a dick.
All right. The Valar are troubled. They call Feanor to answer for his deeds. Those with knowledge or who were there are called upon also, and the part of Melkor is revealed. Tulkas leaves to lay hands upon him. I love that line.
I'm Feanor's, so going to wrestle that guy.
Feanor is exiled for 12 years. Now, the way I understand it, he doesn't have to leave Valinor. He just has to leave sort of the city, right?
Yeah, it's weird because they interchangeably use like Valimar, but he has to leave the city of Valmar, which is in the land of Valinor.
Right. His sons and his father go with him. They make a strong place and hoard many jewels and weapons there. Melkor was hiding because he knew Tulkas was coming for his ass. Tulkas could not find him. Melkor appeared before Feanor at their stronghold and offered to aid Feanor, but Feanor saw through Melkor's lies, and he shut his gates to him. And he has a nice quote there. Let's see. Page flip.
Does anybody else think that it's like, nobody says anything to Feanor about like pulling the sword out and putting it to his like stepbrother's breast. It's not like they're like, hey, Fëanor, what are you doing with the sword, man?
Well, I mean, someone first have to be like, what is this thing? We've never seen this thing before.
Well, they're making them, so they wouldn't be surprised that to see it, but you think they'd be like, he's just carrying that on the open at that point.
Yeah.
Well, I think I think it's like from the last thing we did, number two, where it's like Melkor was like, oh, you might need like swords and armor and shit. Yeah, I don't know. And then they started making them.
But they only, like, I liked how they all hid their swords. They're like, yeah, we got these awesome shields, but, like, I'm the only guy who knows his sword. And, like, every elf in his house has got a sword, but he thinks he's the only guy with a sword.
Under his bed.
Yeah.
But it's just weird. He just walks out with it. Nobody's like, Fëanor, what are you doing, man?
He's feeling his Wheaties now. thinks he's big shit. But he says to Melkor, get thee gone from my gate, thou jailcrow of Mandos. And he shuts his doors in the face of Melkor. The Valar heard about Melkor addressing Fëanor, and they went to catch him, but he escaped again.
Man, those Valar need to be better on their toes.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you think you'd have somebody watching this guy.
No, but it's because Manwë doesn't know evil in his heart, so it's like, oh, go on. And Melkor's like, oh, go on and teach everyone the crafts of making and corrupt their hearts. But, you know.
Well, he's a slow learner.
And Nienna's just sitting on the side going, yes, I'm going to have so much to cry about. I cannot wait. And yeah, then Mandos is just sitting back like, yep, this is going to go poorly. I can see it. And he just lets it happen.
That's where the elves learn their business.
Yeah.
I do appreciate Fëanor's, I guess his, what am I thinking, not desire, but his initiative, I suppose. At least he does something.
Yeah. Fëanor's a dick, but like he deserves to be a dick. It's not like one of those people that are like just like pompous and can't back it up.
Yeah, well, I don't. Yeah, if you are awesome, you know, you can be a jerk, but that doesn't mean you can do whatever you want and break the law. You know what I mean? You can't draw your sword on your brother just because he's calling you out for your bullshit.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because this is like the first time that any of this kind of stuff is happening. So it's kind of like it has to happen and then they have to make rules and, you know, after the fact. Like, if there's a rule for something, it's because someone tried to do it.
Yeah, it's like, no one murdered anyone ever yet. So murder is bad. Like, no one assaulted anyone yet. Assault is bad.
Harel Bereskil Faniel, Sidivren Penamiriel o Menel Aglar Elenath, Nahaired Palandiriel o Galazrem in Enorath, Fanuilos Lelinathon, Nevaya si Nevayaron.
All right, now we're going to discuss Chapter 8 of The Darkening of Valinor, and this is actually a separate recording. I'm joined by Matthew, and so you won't hear Shane, Matt, or Brett on this chapter, but they'll be back to discuss Chapter 9. So I just want to introduce yourself, Matthew, and do your summary.
Hi, so it's Beric, Matthew, for those who listened before. And so, yeah, I'll be talking about Chapter 8 of The Darkening of Valinor, which starts with Melkor fleeing Valinor and going into the south of Man to land of Avatar, where Ungoliant the spider lives. He convinces her to go with him to Valinor and do some evil, which we don't know necessarily what he wants to do at first. But he promises her to give her everything that they find. He promises her that he will give her something with both hands. So it's like he makes her a big promise about the fact that she's going to get something out of it because she's not actually quite sure. The thing is that we are only introduced to her now. I mean, it's not really clear if she's a Maia or not.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, like, because it says that she came from the void, and you know, Melkor corrupted her to his cause, to his service. But are you assuming that she's a Maia and she just took the, you know, or she's something else, something new that we haven't dealt with before?
No, she. I mean, I think it's not clear, but I think it's purposefully not clear because then at least it leaves the door open for, you know, Tolkien's world to be a bit more expansive.
Mm-hmm.
I think the assumption is that she is a Maia because those were the only beings alive, except for the Valar, of course. The closest analogy that I could find probably is that she's maybe reminiscent of chaos, you know, the darkness that was before everything else was. But then again, that would contradict the fact that Melkor was able to seduce her, because then that would mean that she's a force much older than himself, right?
So. Right. I mean, they all came from the void down into Arda, so it's. But also, I found it weird that, you know, there's a giant spider hanging out in heaven.
Yeah.
Or that's like, I mean, you're meant to believe that, I guess the Blessed Realm wasn't like completely, I guess, hallowed at this point, like it was still unformed, but you know, there's just this little mountain region in the south where there's evil, this unspeakable evil being is hanging out a couple hundred miles from heaven, from the city of the gods.
Cockroaches and spiders crawling everywhere. it's actually fairly interesting that she quit, sort of. Maybe she's sort of she wants to be an independent spirit, you know. It's oddly enough, like, even though we don't only see her for this one chapter, she has a lot of personality, I find, in this one chapter.
Yeah, and she echoes all the way down to Lord of the Rings with the giant spiders in Mirkwood, and with Shelob and
her descendants, actually, which is weird. And it's no spoiler that we won't know where she'll end up.
Right.
By the chapter, it just says that, you know, because she's always hungry, that at some point she was starving, and so she ate herself.
Yeah.
In that sense, it's also like, I mean, it's a lot of, it harks back to Northern mythology as well, I think, because you have the Midgard serpent, which is supposed to sort of reach around the world, and then when it sort of eats its, I think when it eats its tail or something like that, the world will end, I think. No, it seems like there's a lot of creation myth going into Ungoliant, because she just pops out of nowhere. So he convinces her to come with him, and she creates the Unlight, which is sort of not, it specifically says that it's not the absence of light, but it's a thing of maybe even an identity, like it's a living being, sort of darkness manifests, and so that is meant to hide them both. They manage to go back to Valinor, like the Valar and the elves, they all have a big feast because they want to celebrate the fact that Melkor has gone. At least they want to be able to sort of take advantage of the fact that there's a little bit of peace now, and so Feanor is there as well. And
you'd think they'd know by this point that, you know, if you're going to have a feast and a festival, that something bad's going to go down.
Yeah. You should probably not gather everyone. Like, just leave a few guards at the outskirts of your kingdom, and then you can maybe. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's more about like who are you gonna or Melkor still by this point. Mm-hmm. So you don't know exactly. I mean, you can't protect yourself from that kind of force, I guess. So yeah, they sort of look down on it and they see the two trees, and so they go to the trees, and so when the trees mingled, and Melkor and Ungoliant sort of come to Ezelohar, where they are, he wounds them with his spear. And yeah, Ungoliant is sort of licking up, because she has sort of like a trunk, which is weird because she looks like she's meant to be a spider, but she has like
a beak. Spiders have those kind of beaks, like Shelob had a little beak, you know. So
she's like, I mean, she reminded me when I read it. She reminded me like of a fly or something like that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the German version, it says like she has like a trunk, like an elephant or something. It's like,
I hope she doesn't have an elephant, because that just makes it more terrifying. But
it says that because she's licking it up, so it's just sort of like I don't know.
I think that's more metaphor, you know. Like, anytime Tolkien gets, we've talked about it, bogged in specifics about science, and it's like, just take it for what it is. Don't go too deep into it.
This is not a science report. So yeah, she licks up the blood of the trees, and she drinks Vada's.
I think they put them in vats. The light that was like the extra light that was just hanging out there.
German version, they say it's like wells.
That's usually how they're represented. And
she empties them as well, and so she grows so fierce and terrifying that even Melkor is sort of afraid, and which is kind of interesting, because I mean, we have this almighty force of evil that's behind everything, but due to the fact that he sort of gives her some of his power, and because he disperses it over all his evil minions, right?
Yeah, so we talk about that later, where it says the more evil he puts into his creations, the more I don't think he gets weaker, but they say he becomes more bound to the world. And I think it's after this chapter that they say he never again changes his physical form. He's always kind of stuck as like a dark lord. were terrible.
But that's
to behold.
Also why, I mean, he still can change his form when he meets her, right?
Right, but not after this.
Then, well, afterwards, when you know, when they have done their evil deed, it sort of says that he will be stuck in that form for forever, basically, yeah. Because he's sort of spent his force, you know. But at the same time, that means he's actually, by making himself weaker, he's made himself stronger, because he has tied his nature to the whole world, right? So he's sort of ethereal in a different way, right? You can't actually get rid of him entirely,
right?
And it's interesting to me that he was sort of afraid of her, because that says a lot about her.
Well, so. you get it a couple times. You know that he's the most powerful of the Valar, but at the same time he's terrified of Tulkas. So it seems like some of the Valar have specific areas where they can kind of overpower others. You know,
a lot of self-confidence issues, right?
Yeah.
He's not really convinced of his own power, and so. Yeah, so the trees, they're dying, basically, and darkness comes over Valinor. But the darkness, obviously, as I said, is sort of not a destruction of light, but is actually a malicious force that seems like a being it's in itself, right?
Yeah, we kind of compared it to, because he goes out of his way to say that it's not just the absence of light, there's something else. So we thought of, like, an evil black hole, like, because it actually sucks in, not physically, it doesn't suck in, like, you know, physical matter, but it just almost takes everything, like, I don't know, like, it's sucking the air, it absorbs everything, yeah.
Which is actually quite frightening when you think about it.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty scary.
You wouldn't know how to get rid of it.
Right. When the Valar can't even get through it, that, you know, it's pretty terrifying. And I can imagine what the elves were thinking, just to, like, what the hell's going on.
But the thing is that Fëanor is supposed to come there, and he doesn't actually apologize. I mean, he just takes Fingolfin's hand, right, and he sort of shakes it. But he doesn't does all the talking, which is actually really important when you think about, you know, what Fëanor's character is.
Yeah, we discussed it on the main discussion about how Fingolfin almost goes out of his way to, like, you know, offer peace and give him a bridge to, but Fëanor he's a dick, and he just keeps, he's not likable, and I always understand where he's coming from, but he's just completely unreasonable. And I like, there's the line where they say that Fëanor was the most powerful, and the most power of reason. I was like, what are you talking about? He's not reasonable. Or an understanding. They said he's the most, most power of understanding.
Yeah, but it's also because I think it comes down to passion, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's his fiery spirit, you know, it's all bound in that.
And that's why I think it's when they say that, you know, it burns with a heat that, you know, it's so intense that, you know, that everyone can feel it. It's sort of, I guess that he's like the artist who cares too much, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably too tied to his own work. His work says something about himself, and so he sees the reflection of himself in whatever he creates. So basically, he wants to, I mean, make sure that he also has an ego complex, right? He also has, like,
his
self-doubts, and, I mean, especially because it's his half-brother, right? So it's not actually...
Well, that's it. It all comes from a misunderstanding from the first time where he walks in and he sees Fingolfin talking to Finwë. His brain automatically goes, this guy's trying to usurp me. But from everything we learn of Fingolfin, he's actually a pretty stand-up guy. And he's like, no, I'm really just here to support you. But he just can't believe that.
He's even vouching for Fëanor on multiple occasions, right?
Well, he says it here. He goes, you know, half-brother in blood, full-brother in heart will I be. Thou shalt lead and I will follow. May no new grief divide us. And Fëanor's like, all right, okay, fine. But still, he never accepts him fully.
He doesn't know what to say because he doesn't think maybe that he has to apologize for anything, really.
Fëanor doesn't know how to love.
No, he doesn't. Well, he knows how to love himself. And
things of thy hands. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is also, I mean, I guess that means that, you know, because the elves were supposed, I mean, Valinor was supposedly a land where no evil could ever enter and thrive and so on.
Well, but, except for giant spiders.
Think about it, Melkor actually just, what he does is he just tells him lies.
Yeah.
But these, I mean, he sort of acts on those by his own accord, right? He's sort of choosing to believe whatever he's been told
because everything Melkor tells him has a grain of truth in it, and he just warps it. He's not just making stuff up. Like, they know that men are coming, and I would assume, I try to, you know, think of it realistically, like, if you're the first created sentient species, and then the gods tell you, hey, this other sentient species is going to come along, but, you know, and then you're going to be worried, you know, unless you're a complete zealot and you believe everything the gods tell you, that it'll be fine.
But yeah, so darkness comes on Valinor, and Manwë sort of knows that it's Melkor's work, and Orome and Tulkas try to catch Melkor, but Turkus is caught in a net of darkness, I think, and they are unable to find him, and so it's sort of like Melkor's plan succeeds.
Yeah, Turkus can't wrestle the darkness, so he's completely baffled as to what he can do.
Yeah, but yeah, that's the sort of I guess that's sort of the broad.
No, that's what we want. That's pretty much what happens. Yeah. The only little thing I want to mention is that the Teleri were the only sort of group of the elves that were not at the party. So they actually did see like this cloud of darkness passing over, and they were all freaked out, and they hid. And so it just goes with the theme of the Teleri never doing what the other elves are doing. They're just hanging out doing their own thing.
But I also think it's a sort of I guess. Melkor is sort of a gambler because he sort of promises Ungoliant whatever she demands, right? Whatever she wants.
Right.
And he promises to give it to her with both hands. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, he didn't really think this through, right? Because if he takes a Silmaril, he has to sort of bank on the fact that she's not going to notice that he's holding them in some way, because she's going to hold him to his word.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're both really devious, so I guess, but at the same time, like, she has the moral high ground here, I guess, later in the next chapter, I guess. You know, he sort of gave his word, and so she's just telling him, you know, you told me that I could have whatever I wanted, so give it to me.
Yeah, well, because he spoke literally, and she took him at his word.
But that's also because there's also it says in the book, at least in the German version, you can sort of like it's an image created like the big fish catching the small one. Mm-hmm. So, but you don't know who is the bigger fish in that moment, and
right.
Later you find that, you know, if she can sort of play on the words that he used, then she's going to be the bigger fish, and she actually literally is bigger than he is at
that point.
So yeah, it's actually, you know, I think he sort of that's also something, he doesn't plan ahead too much. I think he sort of just does things because, you know, that's also what is said, right? He just hates the older beauty and everything. He's sort of impulsive in what he does, and the same thing is fair. No, and that's why I sort of see it like they sort of deserve each other, all three of them. But it's sad because at the same time it talks about free will, you know, in a sense, because Fëanor wasn't actually, you know, even though there is a grain of truth in what Melkor says to him, it doesn't actually mean that,
right? And Tolkien goes out of his way in describing, you know, Fëanor's birth and his, you know, just the way he's put together, that he's the exception to the rule, that most elves are level-headed and he's just the fact that, you know, his body burned up his mother when she was born, and that his wife can't even control him, and she can barely control his children, that he's different, and we know that, you know, when Melkor comes along, that's manifested in the fact that he picks and chooses what parts he's going to accept and what parts he's going to rebel against. And
it's all because, you know, his daddy, you know...
it's all daddy issues. Tolkien, Melkor's got daddy issues, and Fëanor's got daddy issues.
No, that's true. I mean, it's like, yeah, don't be a dick if your father to your children. You know, if your father tried to look out for your children in a level-handed manner.
Right.
It's at least from what we can gather now, at least and by the end of this chapter, it's the beginning of the end, basically, but which means that, I mean, there wasn't much to end, actually, because we didn't spend most of the book in Valinor.
Right. It's like, the real story begins with the theft of the Silmarils, because that's where the name comes from, and that's what that's the main story we're telling.
Yeah, and that's what is revealed to. I mean, it's not revealed in this chapter. Because,
no, but it's coming up.
Harel Bereskli Faniel, Sidivren Penamiriel o Menel Aglar Elenaf. Nahaired Palandiriel o Galazrem in Enorath, Fanuilos Lelinathon, Nevaya si Nevayaron.
So now let's get back to a very critical and prepared discussion for chapter 9 of The Flight of the Noldor. Matt?
Yeah, okay. So this is big time. Melkor kills the trees, and the Valar asks Fëanor to give up the light of the Silmarils to, like, revive the trees. And he's like, well, I can't really do that. And Uli's like, yeah, you can't. You don't know what you really ask of him. Because Fëanor's like, well, yeah, you gave into your life so much power. The same thing I gave into the Cimmerils, and it will really destroy me. And Uli says, yeah, I understand. And
would it destroy him? Or because I just got the impression that he wouldn't be able to recreate it, and he coveted him.
Well,
so,
I mean, really,
maybe it'll destroy his soul.
Fëanor says, I will be the first one to die because if I give up the Cimmerils, like,
okay,
that's it. And Mando says, not the first.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so it turns out that Melkor attacked Fëanor's home, killed his father, stole all the jewels, including the Cimmerils. So Morgoth and Ngolion go to the north where, was it Helcaraxes?
Helcaraxa.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
Yeah. And Melkor had said that he would give Ngolion everything he had with two hands. And so he fed this huge giant spider all the jewels that Fëanor and the Noldor had, and she still thirsted. And she's like, you said with both hands. And he's like, fuck you. I have the Cimmerils in, like, one hand, and they're burning the shit out of me like gonorrhea. And, like,
because they're hallowed, and hallowed does nothing except burn Melkor a little bit.
Yeah, there we go. So she's like, well, you just fucking cheated me out there. So she wound him up with shadow twine and shit like that. And he screamed so loud that the land was named Llama. And then all his Balrogs came out and ripped up her shadowy twines with their fiery whips.
I'd like to see that.
She went to Nan Gongarthed, otherwise known as Valley of Dreadful Death.
Because she was
dead. I said that was an awesome name. Because Nan Gongarthed.
And it's also the mountains of Ered Gorgoroth, which is the same mountains that are in Mordor, the Mountains of Terror.
Also the same mountains that Beren will go through later on. Mm-hmm. Morgoth goes back to the ruins of Angband, begins to build his fortress, and he sets the Cimmerils into his Iron Crown, which will also be important later on. Fëanor convinces the Noldor to leave Aman and return to Middle-earth to seek the Cimmerils and destroy Morgoth. Okay, so this is where the awesome speeches come on.
Indeed. All right, cool. So basically at this point, Fëanor, you know, all the people of the Noldor are roused up because their High King was just murdered, and he's like, I'm the High King now, and we're going to get the hell out of here, and we're going to go to Middle-earth, and we're going to take the Silmarils back. And not everybody is really with him because they're not all like, hey, why are you our king? Why not Fingolfin or the other guy? So Fëanor is all riled up, and he, you know, draws his sword, and he gives this amazing speech, and it's some of the most beautiful writing in the entire book, I think. But this is probably my favorite passage, where he says, why, O people of the Noldor, why should we longer serve the jealous Valar, who cannot keep us, nor even their own realm secure from their enemy? And though he be now their foe, are not they and he of one kin? Vengeance calls me hence, but even were it otherwise, I would not dwell longer in the same land with the kin of my father's slayer, and of the thief of my treasure. Yet I am not the only valiant of this valiant people. And have ye not all lost your king? And what else have ye not lost, cooped here in a narrow land between the mountains and the sea? Here once was light, that the Valar begrudged to Middle-earth, but now dark levels all. Shall we mourn here, deedless forever, a shadow folk mist-haunting, dropping vain tears in the thankless sea? Or shall we return to our home? In Quivienen sweet ran the waters under unclouded stars, and wide lands lay about, where a free people might walk. There they lie still, and await us who in our folly forsook them. Come away, let the cowards keep this city. I get chills when I read that. I've read this is like my fifth time through, and I literally break out in goosebumps when I read this passage. Because we know what's happening, and this is really where it starts, where he binds his people to this unfulfillable oath, basically.
Oh, yeah.
I get the point he makes right here, but for him to compare Melkor / Morgoth to the other Valar, how would he feel if they compared other elves to him? Do you know what I mean? Like, he thinks he's so much better than all the other elves. Obviously, he thinks he's better than Fingolfin. If they compared him to them, he would probably be outraged. He's like, I am better than them. And they'd be like, you see? It's kind of the same here.
You see, but I get what he's saying. Like, okay, we have these gods that say they're gods, and one of them...
They're sitting on their ass.
Yeah,
I completely understand that, because anytime something, it's like the Valar always have to stop, and they're very measured about their responses. They never react hastily to anything. But at the same time, they do. There was the line a couple of chapters back at how they're not the masters of the Eldar, but they're more their elders, I believe. Or they're guiding them, but they're not telling them what to do. It's all suggestive and like, hey, we think we know what's best, but if you want to go do your thing, go do your thing. And I kind of like that kind of, I don't want a god that's necessarily telling me what to do and telling what you can and can't do, but at this point, I wish cooler heads would have prevailed.
Yeah, I feel like if we fast forward to the future and it's men saying, let's go kill him, the elves would have been like, well, let's calm down and just think about how we're going to do this. But this time, it's the elves being all like, let's just charge out there and take down Morgoth. Kind of weird how it's like the youth of their race.
But I think we also have to try to keep in mind, like, there's nothing comparable to the Silmarils. Like, I'm trying to, I mean, yeah, the Rings of Power, but this is like a whole nother thing. This is like the light of creation that is in these things, and they're the most beautiful things anyone's ever seen. They're unbreakable, and the guy who created them has just lost them, and he knows he can never make them again. So I do understand. He calls it the rape of the Silmarils, and, you know, he works in the clever line of, and we're going to get my treasure back, right in the middle of this awesome speech. You know, he buries the lead a little bit there. But,
right. They say, fair shall be the end, though long and hard shall be the road. Say farewell to bondage. Say farewell to ease. Say farewell to weak. Say farewell to treasure. More still shall we make. Journey light, but bring with you your swords. For we should go further than Arome, endure longer than Tulkas. We never turn back from pursuit after Morgoth to the ends of the earth. War shall he have and hatred undying. But when we have conquered and have regained the Silmarils, then we, and we alone, shall be lords of the Unsullied Light and the masters of bliss and beauty of Arda. No other race shall joust us.
Oust us.
Oust us? Would I say joust us?
Something like that.
No one will joust with us, because we don't have horses yet.
Yeah. I'm getting kind of a weird... kind of Nazi turn there at the end of that. Am I the only one? But the race, no other race shall oust us, and we will be lords of the earth.
Well, I think that's because Melkor poured all these lies about how men are coming and men are going to take over the elves. I think that's what he's referring. I don't think he's referring to like other types of elves or another sect.
Just stuck out in my head toward the end there. He kind of turned it.
Like, I kind of get it, but like, I don't think it's really like a complete commanding thing. They just want to destroy the evil lord who actually wants to be like,
yeah, if anyone's Nazis in the story, it's Melkor.
And regain the Silmarils, and doing that, they Fëanor and all his sons called down an everlasting oath that would tie them together no matter what happened. So they said, thus spoke Maedros, Maglor, and Caligrim, Curfum, Carathirn, Amrod, Amros, princes of the Noldor, and May, Quail, to hear the dread words. So sworn, good or evil, an oath may not be broken, and it shall pursue the oath keeper and oath breaker to the ends of the world. So.
It's kind of weird that we don't actually, we get like a summary of the oath, but we don't actually get, in quotes, them taking the oath.
Yeah, I saw that in your notes, and I also found that weird. Like, although he made that huge speech, you don't hear the oath.
Right.
Maybe no elf ever wanted to write it down. It was so bad.
Well, yeah, I mean, he named, like, the Valar, and that was basically what made the oath, like, he named it against the Valar and Eru, and that's what made it so binding.
This kind of reminds me of the movie Excalibur, because everybody's so dramatic in that movie. Are you with us or against us? Against you! They ride off and fight. But I guess, you know, like Greg said, it's, you know, the Silmarils, we don't have anything comparable. And Feanor was a hothead anyway.
Well, he had a soul of fire.
True. Get a Galadriel name drop.
Oh, yeah. Galadriel's coming up.
Oh, yeah. So she also, like, didn't take part of the curse, but she also was like, I want to go back to Middle-earth.
I'd like to go some shit.
Can I ride with y'all?
Yeah, basically. She's like, I mean, I don't like this at all, but I still desire Middle-earth.
Well, she desired to make a realm of her own, is what it said.
It's a tyrant.
Right, with Celeborn.
Celeborn.
Well, they never name Celeborn here, though, do they?
No, it's Celegorm. Celeborn is, I think, the son of Thingol Eru?
No, he's a Sindarin elf, but I don't think he's related to Thingol.
Okay, anyway, that will come.
Thingol only had one child, later. And that was Luthien.
Yeah, fair enough. So, Manwë exiles Feanor, but the Noldor are, like, allowed to stay, but Feanor says, hey, come on, all you guys, let's go. We can create kingdoms of our own and throw down Morgoth, and we don't need these people that can't even defend their own lands. Feanor says to him, say this to Manwë Silumna, High King of Arda. If Feanor can't overthrow Morgoth, at least he delays not to assail him and sits not idle in grief. And it may be that Eru has set in me a greater fire that shall know. Such hurt at least will I do to the foe of the Valar, that even the mighty of the Ring of Doom shall wander here. Yea, in the end, they shall follow me. Farewell. So basically, it's just like, bitch, you're not doing anything.
Shit. I'm doing what you're supposed to be doing. And in a, I mean, I guess it's kind of a spoiler, but he's kind of right in the end.
He's basically calling him out. Like, dude, you're not fucking up this guy.
But part of the reason why the Valar don't act very often is because when they do, it is incredible. Like, things just get destroyed when they clash. It's crazy. And that's one of the reasons why they keep sitting back, because it too much power is let loose when they battle one another.
Yeah, the land has always changed, and that's why they were wary to attack him in the first place, because they knew the elves were coming soon, and they didn't want to mess that up.
And they actually, like, cordoned the elves off the last time they actually had to take down Melkor, but now the elves are, like, strewn out about Beleriand,
right.
And they, you know, they can't just pick them all up and say, come this way, because we're about to fight Melkor now. It's kind of tough. And plus, men should be coming sometime. The Valar know this, but the elves really don't know much about it.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, they still do.
They still do what?
Like, fuck up the world a lot of times.
And only as a last resort, but let's not spoil that for the people going forward.
All right, so Feanor tries to go to Teleri, that were the shipbuilders, and he tries to convince them to leave Aman and go to Middle-earth, and they're like, nope. So Feanor talks to Olwë, who was one of the guys with Finwë, his father, that came over to Aman.
One of the originals.
Yeah.
He's one of the big three.
Yeah, one of the big three. He's like, we renounce no friendship, but it may be part of a friend to rebuke a friend's father. And when the Noldor welcomed us and gave us aid, otherwise then you spoke in the land of Aman. We were to dwell forever as brothers whose houses stand side by side. But as for our white ships, you gave us not. We learned not that craft from the Noldor, but from the Lord of the Sea, and the white timbers we wrought with our own hand, and the white sails were woven by our wives and our daughters. Therefore we will neither give them nor sell them for any league or friendship. For I say to you, Feanor, son of Fenwë, these are to us as are the gems of the Noldor, the works of our hearts, those like we shall never make again. So instead of, like, Feanor being like, oh, so these are like your Silmarils? That's pretty cool.
I understand that. All right, cool. See you later.
Nope.
This is where it really crosses the line.
Yeah, kinslaying.
this is like unheard of. I mean, yes, he drew a sword on his brother, his half brother, and that was like almost unforgivable. He got exiled for that, but he basically leads, he slaughters his own people in his hot-headedness, and just the way this all goes down, it's just, it's a gut punch, and I have a tough time rooting for him, even though he thinks he's the hero, but he gets everyone involved in it, his sons and everyone, and they have no choice but to join him in this, and it's brutal.
Yeah, and it's because of the oath that they all took, but what's worse is Fingolfin coming on to this and seeing, like, oh my god, the Teleri are, like, and so all his soldiers start killing the Teleri too, and he doesn't even realize why this is happening.
And the Teleri don't have swords. They're fighting them with, like, oars and arrows and, like, cheap little bows. It's a slaughter.
Yeah, it sucks.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Feanor's like, man, I'm glad we made these swords.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in the show notes, I put a picture in there that I always imagine the Doom of Mandos looking, like, similar. And he said, and they heard a loud voice, solemn and terrible, that bade them stand and give ear. Then all halted and stood still, and from end to end, the host of the Noldor, the voice was heard speaking the curse and prophecy, which is called the prophecy of the North and the doom of the Noldor. Much is foretold in dark words, which the Noldor understood not until the woes indeed after befell them, but all heard the curse and was uttered upon those that would not stay nor seek the doom and pardon of the Noldor. So this is when Finarfin left.
This is basically after the slaughter, that they're about to leave, and this banner bearer, a show, you know, comes upon the mountains, and he's telling the people what it is, and we're meant to believe this is Mandos, because there was some debate as to was it actually Mandos or was it a servant of Mandos, but it's the doom of Mandos, and we're meant to believe that it's the Valar himself actually showed up, and he's like, this is what you've wrought, you've done this on yourselves, and you're gonna have to live with this now.
Right. The first one was a vassal of Mandos. I was like, yeah, I'll do this. And Feanor's like, fuck you. And after the kinslaying, Mandos comes up and he's like, tears unnumbered ye shall shed, and the Valar will fence Valinor against you and shut you out, so that not even the echo of your lamentation shall pass over the mountains. On the house of Feanor, the wrath of Valar lieth from the west unto the uttermost east, and upon all that will follow them, it shall be laid so. Their oath shall drive them, and yet betray them, and ever snatch away the very treasures that they sworn to pursue. To evil end shall all things turn, that they begin well, and by treason of kin unto kin, and the fear of treason, shall this come to pass. The dispossessed shall they be forever.
This gets back to my thing about Yavanna. It's like, are they proclaiming it, or are they predicting it? I always wonder.
Thunk.
I think what he's saying is, because you made this oath, this is what's going to happen to you. And I think he's just stating it, and he has seen it, and he does know what's going to happen, but he's not going to do anything to prevent it.
He's also not being super specific. It's like a fortune teller almost. Like, bad stuff's going to happen, and yeah, you're going to lies, and there'll be trust issues. But it's just showing how the oath, even from the get go, it was a bad thing, and even at the earliest point, they're regretting it already.
Well, I don't know if they are, but.
Some of them are.
They will. Well, you find they are, because this is when Finarfin taps out and goes back home.
Yeah, but he didn't take the oath.
I'm out.
Yeah, but they're with him. I mean,
we're
only to believe that just Feanor and his sons took the oath, right? It's everyone else is. They're not just along for the ride. They're one people. I mean, there's only three tribes in the world of this, you know, in the Blessed Realm, and I guess they would feel obligated to stick together.
Yeah, the oath only affects him and his sons, but the Noldor have all been banished until they prove themselves worthy.
Unless they seek the pardon of the.
Right. That's what I mean by prove themselves worthy.
Yeah, we'll see that later, but. So, yeah, Finarfin's like, nah, we're out. But his sons, Fingolfin and Fingon?
Fingon?
Maybe. anyway, his sons don't turn back.
The ships really intrigue me. Like, I want to know, like, they talk them up like these are some really special ships. And I can understand Silmarils, the light from the trees, their jewels. I'm like, what specifically about these ships is so badass, you know?
Well, these are the same ships that brought them there, right?
Pulled by swans.
I hope they have masks. They've taught them how to make ships.
Do you think you know how they make like sails?
Yeah, but they said like the Silmarils, we'll never be able to make their like again.
I think like humans, they clear cut all the white trees they made them out of. So poor planning. I don't know.
They're weirwood ships, obviously.
Mask faces.
Pulled by ravens.
It's not like these ships are
white
like
ravens.
Yeah.
Bam.
It's not like these ships are magical or anything. Like some of them don't even make it.
Right. But they were created by the gods or with the help of the gods. So it's almost like, you know, how Yavanna was involved in the Silmarils. But I just just want to read the second paragraph because this is a lot of the, you know, he lays it all out on the table.
Oh, when they landed?
No, where you read the dispossessed, shall they ever be? That next paragraph is kind of puts, you know, seals the deal for the Noldor.
Oh, yeah. Dude.
Where he says, you have spilled the blood of your kindred unrighteously and have stained the land of Aman. For blood ye shall render blood, and beyond Aman ye shall dwell in death's shadow. For though Eru appointed to you to die not in Ea, and no sickness may assail you, yet slain ye may be, and slain ye shall be, by weapon and by torment and by grief. And your houseless spirit shall come then to Mandos. There long shall ye abide and yearn for your bodies, and find little pity, though all whom ye have slain should entreat for you. And those that endure in Middle-earth and come not to Mando shall grow weary of the world, as with a great burden, and shall wane and become as shadows of regret before the younger race that cometh after. The Valar have spoken. So
he's basically telling them what's going to happen to him in the Third Age.
Yeah, because that's basically what the elves are going through at that point, and they're trying to get back to go back to Valinor.
Well, there's not actually that many Noldor left in the Third Age.
Well, Galadriel is one of the
Galadriel
last.
Is, yeah. But that's pretty much it, isn't it?
Well, that's what happens to all the elves.
Right, they all dwindle, but...
Dwindle the elf?
Okay, to finish up my long, long episode... So Fëanor takes all the ships after the Kingslaying, and he goes to Middle-earth. And then he says, but when they landed, Mahadros, the eldest of his sons, and at a time a friend of Fingon, ere Morgoth's lies came between, spoke to Fëanor saying, now what ships, rowers, will you spare to return, and whom shall they bear hither? Fingon the Valiant? Then Fëanor laughed as one fain, he cried, none and none. What I have left behind, I count as no loss. Needless baggage on the road is proved. Let those that curse my name curse me still, and while their way back to the cages of the Valari, let their ships burn.
Yeah, because he hasn't done enough dick moves this chapter.
Does that sound like an orc talking? Like, sounds like something an orc would say.
And then the last one is like, Fingolfin and the others were forced to turn back to the Helcaroxy. They braved the ice, and many were lost along the way. They finally arrived in Middle-earth at the first rising of the moon. And personally, I like how the moon rose and they blew their trumpets. Like, I don't know, it's in a chapter maybe two or three away, but it's a really, like, kind of awesome thing.
Well, they've come through, like, we're led to believe the grinding ice is, they say that it's the toughest thing to get through, and it's, you know, many were lost along the way. Turgon's wife died. And
yeah, right.
It's this unpassable, and, like, I pictured, because Fëanor basically slips out of, after they take the ships, he's like, they sneak away from Fingolfin and his host.
And yeah, because they don't have enough ships to carry everybody.
Right, but like, it wasn't like, hey, we're going to come back for you. Like, they didn't even, he just left. And
Yeah, Fingolfin sees, like, this bright fire in the sky, and he's like, we're betrayed.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Son of a bitch. We're going to have to walk the shit.
How is it that they didn't have enough ships? I mean, if everybody was there, everybody came over on ships, right?
Yeah, the Teleri were supposed to be the greatest of the hosts, but maybe a lot of the ships were out. They weren't all in port at the time.
Oh, maybe.
Can't get bogged down in the specifics. Anytime numbers and science, we just have to, like, go, okay, and then just keep going.
Yeah, maybe they ferried, you know, host by host.
Yeah. Maybe Cirdan had a bunch over there still, or Cirdan, whatever you call him. Maybe he still had a bunch over there just to send elves over when they wanted to go.
Yeah. But this is another thing that just endeared Fingolfin to me more, because he's like, I can't go back because we just committed, you know, fratricide, and we're going to have to go. And, you know, they went through the toughest thing and they finally get there. And that is a really awesome, just rousing scene of them blowing their trumpets as the moon's shining for the first time. And and they're like, I can't wait to get to Feanor. I want to bitch slap him so hard.
I just feel really bad for Fingolfin, because it's all like a misunderstanding to him. Like,
I know.
He just came upon them fighting, and he was like, oh, the Valar must have set them against us to keep us from leaving. We must protect our brethren. And he just didn't even understand. And then afterwards, like, Mandos comes down, and he's like, what the fuck?
Well, my holes have been empty, and now they're full. What happened?
The worst with Fingolfin is him just saying, like, I'm a brother to you, Feanor. Whatever you want to do, I'll follow you. And that's why, like, yeah, when he comes on to the Teleri, you know, Kingslaying, he's like, oh, the Teleri must have fucked him over. I gotta go defend my brother-in-law. Let's do this.
Yeah, that was a bad call, Fingolfin.
He's trying to do the right thing, though. He didn't want Feanor to think that he was, because he never was trying to usurp him, really. It all went back to that. He overheard him talking with Finwë.
And it's not like he's gonna walk up in the middle of battle and be like, wait, everybody stop. Why are we fighting? No, you just join the fight.
Hold on, what's this?
Yeah, Feanor, I'm gonna say no. This is your bet.
There's no turning back at this point for the Noldor. They've got to go through with it and hope for the best.
But the fact that they burn the ships, it's like, why? What is the reasoning behind that?
Don't think about the past. You got to move forward.
Huh?
Because you got to move forward.
Did he not want his people to want to turn back? Is that why he burned them?
I think so. So no one go back.
Finrod's a dick. He's like, oh, fuck them. Like, we don't have to bring them across. Like, I'm going to take on Morgoth myself.
That's another thing, is that it's kind of interesting about all this, is how powerful they must be. I mean, these are, for lack of a better term, the gods. They're not God, but they're basically like the gods. And Feanor is like, I'm going to go take down that one, the one all the other gods are afraid to fight. And he more or less does. He goes, you know, he makes war against him.
I won't say they're afraid to fight him. They're afraid of the outcome of the fight to the earth. That they're not really scared. I don't think they're scared of Melkor.
They're not scared, well, because they're all the same, but they do know he is the most powerful of them, and like you said, if they do take him on, there's going to be vast consequences.
Yeah. Well, could you imagine, like, what's the elves in Lord of the Rings?
What do you mean?
One with the blue ring. Elrond.
One with the blue ring?
Elrond. Can you imagine Elrond, like, going to war against the gods?
No, but
like, I know he's a different kind of elf.
But that's what, like, Feanor's speech is all about. It's like, I have a fire in me more than you know, and I'm gonna fucking punch this guy like really hard. And all my sons are also gonna fucking kick this guy's ass. And yeah, whatever you say about, like, it might bite us in the ass later, yeah, whatever, we'll do more than you'll do. And that was a big thing. It was like, we will fucking fight him and you will not, and you'll just watch. And I really think that's like what he's saying, is just like,
well, he believes his talk, there's no doubt about that.
He's like, for good or bad, we're fighting this guy and you guys are sitting on your ass.
I feel like, how could he even, like, he's clearly not a good fighter. I mean, he's never had to fight anybody.
He lost to a Balrog.
That's just it. Does he even know? Anyway, like, does he know about Balrogs? Because it's like he thinks it's just Morgoth all by himself. I don't understand why he thinks that they can take him on. And they don't even need the rest of the Noldor. They're like, fuck the ships, burn them, let's go get him. What is going on in his head?
He's not level-headed, and he's not thinking, you know, he's not thinking straight.
Right. Yeah. All he's thinking is, I want my Silmarils back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he killed my father, prepared to die.
Exactly.
Arel Bereskluthoniel, Sidivren Penamiriel o Menel Aglarelenath, Nahaired Palandiriel o Galazrem Minenorath, Fanuilos Lelinathon Nevaia si Nevaeron.
All right, so let's move on to chapter 10, which gives us a little more insight as to what's going on in Middle-earth the last, you know, three ages of the world while Melkor was in captivity. And this is basically the world that the Noldor are showing up in out of nowhere.
Right, so we rewind before the trees are even been taken down. Okay. In Middle-earth, Elwë, or Thingol as we'll call him from now on, he and Melian, his Maiar wife, are ruling over the Sindar, which are pretty much all the elves that came west but never made it to Valinor. Although they were all but Thingol Moriquendi, which means they never saw the light of the two trees in bloom, under the lordship of Thingol and the teaching of Melian, they became the fairest and the most wise and skillful of all the elves of Middle-earth. While Melkor was subdued and there was peace, Melian gave birth to her and Thingol's only child. Her name was Luthien. And when she was born, the white flowers of Nifrindil came forth to greet her as the stars from the earth, which I guess is awesome. I don't really know. She was born and flowers bloomed. Way to go. All right. So also in this time of peace, the dwarves made their way across the Blue Mountains into Beleriand. The dwarves called themselves Khazad, but since the elves are racist, they call them the Naugrim, which means the stunted people. How mean is that? When the dwarves showed up and they're like, yeah, we're called the Khazad, they're like, whatever, you're the Naugrim, look at you. Seems kind of mean to me, and I feel it's kind of racist. And I could see why they would have cool relations after that. So the elves were filled in amazement to discover another speaking race. Though
they
called
them the Gonarim too. I just realized that. That's some other connotations.
The master.
You're stunted and you've got STDs.
The elves were filled with amazement to discover another speaking race, though they found the dwarven speech to be cumbrous and unlovely. So most of the dwarves just learned to speak the elven tongue, which was cool with them because they didn't want to share their shit anyway. And Thingol welcomed them with open arms. It's like, come, the little stunted people. Come to me. The dwarves built trade routes between them, and the elves... And the dwarves both profited from this. Though in the end, the dwarves would end up liking the Noldor more because of their closeness to Aule, their maker. So Melian had the foresight to tell Thingol, hey, look, there's probably not going to be such a peaceful area to live in after a while, so we should probably do something about this place we live in. So we decided to build a stronghold. And he commissioned the dwarves to help with the building. And Melian paid them with knowledge and Thingol with pearls from Curdan that he had plucked from the sea. The dwarves dealt them halls in a rocky hill in the midst of the forest by the flowing of the river Esgalduin.
Sound good?
Esgalduin. Look at you. You're way better than me. So the dwelling was vast, great, and given the name Menengroth, which means thousand caves.
Do we know where Menengroth is now? Or not now, but like in the time of the Middle Earth?
It's gone.
Or, I mean, is it gone? Okay. Lord of the Rings, I mean.
It's gone. You'll find out why later on.
Okay.
So the dwarves didn't do it by themselves. The elves had their part. And I'm going to just read this passage because I like it. They wrought out of the visions of Melian images of the wonder and beauty of Valinor beyond the sea. The pillars of Menengroth were hewn in the likeness of the beeches of Orome, stalk, bow, and leaf, and they were lit with lanterns of gold. The nightingales sang there as in the gardens of Lorien, and there were fountains of silver and basins of marble, the floors of many colored stones. Carven figures of beasts and birds there ran upon the walls or climbed upon the pillars or peered among the branches entwined with many flowers. And as the years passed, Melian and her maidens filled the halls with woven hangings wherein could be read the deeds of the Valar and the many things that had befallen Arda since the beginning and the shadow of the things that were yet to come. That was the fairest dwelling of any king that has ever been east of the sea. So basically it is the nicest place the elves ever created.
Yeah, this is one of the there's a couple places throughout the books that I can picture really well, and he does these really beautiful descriptions, and I would definitely like to hang out at Menengroth for a couple endless centuries and take in the lovely architecture. But it's weird that like the elves have this sort of love, this like cool, you know, relationship with the dwarves, but basically the dwarves built this amazing place for them.
Right. They dug it out of the mountains.
Right. The elves hung the drapes.
Yes.
Basically it sounds like it. They carved
the stone.
Did the
decorating.
Yeah, the dwarves, they're so cool to the elves, and bad things happen to them, and it makes me sad. It's weird that the elves live in caves to me. I don't know why. Like, obviously they did in The Hobbit, but it's just strange. Like, when I picture elves, I picture them being in the forest and just running around, but Menengroth is built in caves.
Well, I picture them working, like, the trees into it, and it's not just, like, this dark you know, I think it's like Rivendell, but but caves.
Well, I kind of pictured it. I think they did a pretty good job in the last Hobbit movie, The Desolation of Smaug.
Yeah, and the woodland realm of...
Yeah, the way they incorporate the trees into the caves and stuff.
And these are basically all part of the same, you know, the elves of Mirkwood are the descendants, or they were part of the same people of Thingol at some point.
Yeah. They actually, that place is actually built in memory of this place. It is.
Well, that's a debate, because they say the first sundering, like, we're led to believe that those elves that went south, that's where they went, was to Mirkwood, and this place hadn't been built yet.
I'm pretty sure that it's built in the memory of this, because I think the guy that ran that was from here.
Thranduil,
yes. He's actually lived there. I mean, they don't mention it in this.
Sorry, Thranduil. There we go.
Eyebrows.
Yeah, but Ira Thingol got killed. I don't know.
A spoiler there, son? What are you doing?
Oh, sorry.
Well, anyone who looks at a map of Middle-earth will notice that it kind of ends at the Blue Mountains, and all this is past the Blue Mountains. So people with a critical eye will know that something's going down to all this land at some point.
And we're going to assume whoever's not in the Lord of the Rings, they probably got killed, or they left Middle-earth. So.
True enough. If they're an elf and they're not in Lord of the Rings, they died.
Like, how does Curdin just stand there forever?
And grow a beard.
Yes, yeah, he grew a beard. Which, they never specifically say that no elves have beards. It's just, I don't know, it's weird that that one elf, he points out the fact that he does have a beard.
Well, he's the oldest elf we meet. Like, he's literally, other elves?
He's November.
Yeah. Aside from Galadriel, we really, in Lord of the Rings, there's no elves from that awoke at Cui Vienin, and he's supposed to be one of them, right?
He could be one of them, yes. Right. He was at Cui Vienin at one point. I don't know if he was one of the originals that woke there, but he was from there.
Yeah.
So he's older than Treebeard? I thought Treebeard was the oldest thing on Middle-earth.
And he's got a beard. His name is Treebeard.
All right.
Maybe the elves just like to shave, and he was like, I'm not shaving.
He grew a mustache. He was like, come on, guys. Let's go over the sea. Come on.
All right, let's talk about Curdin when he actually shows up, because he's not in this chapter yet.
All right, so, well, interesting, we're talking about the sea. It's like the dwarves, they never went to the sea, and they feared to look upon it. Why do you think – do you think it's because they're, like, were made from stone and they can't swim? They just sink to the bottom?
Yeah, I'm sure that's
That's my little theory. That's my little theory. Yeah. You can shoot it down if you want.
Well, I think it's because the elves awoke by water. There's always this mythical association of, like, peace and being and communing with the gods between the elves. You know, even like when Legolas sees the sea for the first time, this amazing yearning comes over him and he sings his lovely song. But they say, like, the first time the dwarves saw the sea or heard the sea, they were scared of it, because they're created by Aule, who's got nothing to do with water. He's stone and mountain and creation, and that's their thing. So it's they just don't have the same connection to it that the elves do.
But do you think if Omo blew his horn, they'd be like, oh, the sea, I love it? That's what he did to the elves, because they were scared at first, too. And then he blew his horn, and they were like, yeah, now we want to go west real bad.
It does say anyone who hears those horns will love the sea and never forget. So I'd say they would, but it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, he didn't give a shit about that. All right, so the dwarves warn the elves that Melkor's minions were starting to stir again in Middle-earth, and that their kin in the Far East were flying from the plains to the hills, which believe the elves have wings? Yeah?
No.
Yeah? So,
get to the battle.
Calm down. Also, some baddies were returning from over the mountains, like some wolves or what they thought were wolves, shadows and orcs and all sorts of things. So Thingol took thought for arms, which his people had never needed before. He looked to the dwarves, for they were a warlike race. They had been battling for a long time against anyone who aggrieved them, including other dwarves. The Valar never came to protect them. So the Sindar learned from the dwarves to create weapons and armor and filled their armories for the darkness to come. Some more elves showed up because they heard Thingol had a cool-ass kingdom, and the time of Melian was just at its noontime, so she had all this power. So the darkness came to Valinor, and Melkor slew the great trees and returned once again to Middle-earth. Only the power of Melian kept Ungoliant in check from her flight from the servants of Melkor, and Melkor retook his stronghold in Angband, just 50 leagues from the gates of Menengroth, far and yet all too near. Which, it doesn't really seem like it's that far away to me.
Yeah, they say it's 150 leagues, which, you know, the league isn't a there's different definitions of a league, but it's basically 87 miles around there, which seems super close.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually further than that. It's not even on the map in the book. Like, it's cut off before Angband.
Maybe leagues are just a general term.
Definitely has like a mountain range in between them anyway.
So Melkor sent forth his orcs filled with lust of ruin and death to assault the elves. They got forces in the lands between Thingol and Menegroth and Curdan at Eglarist. And Thingol decided, I'm going to attack these bitches. So him and Denethor attacked the orcs from both sides. And the poor orcs that didn't get massacred between them went north and got waylaid by the dwarves and their sharp steel axes. Poor orcs. They just didn't even see it coming. And few indeed returned to Angband. But the victory was dearly bought, for Denethor and his followers were cut off, surrounded, and killed before Thingol could come to their aid. Denethor's people never took another king and never went to open war again, and kind of just became peaceful little farmers. And also, Curdan's forces were driven to the rim of the sea. So Thingol then withdrew all his forces into the vastness of Noldoreth and Regian, and Melian put forth her power and fenced all that dominion round with an unseen wall of shadow and bewilderment called the Girdle of Melian. None thereafter could pass against her will or the will of the king, unless one should come with greater power than Melian, the Maiar. This land was then called Doriath, the guarded kingdom, the land of the girdle. Within there was a watchful peace, but peril and great fear without, and all the servants of Morgoth roamed at will. But new tidings were at hand, unseen by Morgoth or Melian, and this time Fëanor came over the sea just burned the white ships of the Teleri.
Yeah, so the Girdle of Melian, we're led to believe that that's kind of the same thing that Galadriel kind of puts around Lorien in Lord of the Rings. This, you know, net that keeps the bad guys out, and only people who she wants in can come in.
Right, you just go in and you get all confused and turned around and then end up walking out again.
Right. What was I doing again? But also, it's good to keep in mind also, this is the battle between the elves and the orcs and the dwarves. This is considered the first battle of the Wars of Beleriand, and there will be several more going forward. And the first time I read this, I actually had a little cheat sheet where I was writing down the different battles, and I tried to find it, but I couldn't. But this is basically the beginning of the official Wars of Beleriand. It's pretty minor compared to what comes later, but it is important that Denethor was killed. And Círdan and his people are basically besieged now in the Eglarist.
It's strange that the elves kind of did the same thing as the Valar. They just pulled in and then wait.
Guard their borders.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really send out any...
Or do they?
Well, that's basically what they've done there. I mean, maybe it's because Melian's like, this is what I would do if I were you, because she's a Maiar, and that's what Maiar do.
Well, I think they're kind of regrouping too, right? Because this is the first battle. They're like, what the shit's going on? We got to protect ourselves. Okay, let's settle down. Get the shit settled, and then, you know, I don't know what happens next, but, you know, maybe they'll go on the offensive or get some kind of strategy.
Yeah, like, hey, Melian, maybe you could make us a magical invisible fence so none of them could get in here? And she's like, fucking done.
And we also meet, we're told that the dwarves are actually the best, like, swordsmiths, even better than the elves, and there's very few dwarves that are actually named in the Silmarillion, and there might only be a couple, but Telkar is named here, and he's the smith with was greatest in renown. He actually is believed to be the guy who actually forged the Narsil, the sword of that Aragorn has in Lord of the Rings.
The only reason why I leave stuff like that out is because it's like, do people listening really need another name? That will never come up again.
It's also Telkar doesn't sound like a dwarf. It sounds like an elf. I don't know.
When is he supposed to have made Narsil? Because Narsil couldn't be a dwarf sword. That thing's like 6 feet tall.
He made it for the elves.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But it wasn't. It doesn't look like a gnomish blade, but I guess if you're a dwarf. I'm going off the movie, my idea of the movie sword, too. It's not curved and flowery.
Right.
But okay.
Right, it's like a broadsword. Yeah. That seems dwarvish to me.
They didn't all use axes. All right, so the wars are, you know, have begun in earnest. There's kind of like a watchful, not peace, but the lines have been drawn, and now all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you know, Fëanor and Fingolfin, all these elves are showing up, been away for thousands of years.
Arel Berethlu Foniel, Sidivren Penamiriel o Menel Aglar Elenath, Nahaired Palandiriel o Galazrem in Enorath, Fanuilos Lelinathon, Nevaya, Si Nevayaron.
And now we get to Chapter 11, which is of the Sun and Moon and the Hiding of Valinor, and I've got the recap for this one. After Melkor and Ungoliant destroy the two trees, the Valar, they meet in the Ring of Doom to plan their response. We also find out here that they never really speak, they just take counsel with using their kind of mental powers, which is pretty cool. The Valar mourn for Fëanor also, since he was the mightiest of the living elves in beauty, understanding, skill, and strength. And I don't think this can possibly be true, because he's definitely not the best in understanding. Messengers arrive in Valinor with Fëanor's response to the Valar's offer to return. Manwë weeps, and Mandos tells the Valar that Fëanor will come to him soon. Yavanna and Nienna then put forth all their powers in an attempt to bring the trees back to life. They're unsuccessful, but Telparion bears one final flower, and Lorelin bears one single fruit, and then they die completely. These were then given to Aule, who made great vessels to put them in, and Manwë hallowed them, and Varda placed them in the sky, and they set them on their appointed paths. The moon, who's known as Isil, was made from the flower of Telparion, and the sun, which was called Arion, was made from the fruit of Lorelin. And now we get this weird pseudo-scientific explanation of how the sun and moon started, and I was completely confused the first time I read it, because it seems like they start going west to east, and then they stop, and then they redo it. But I really wish we didn't get any of this. It was just they went up in the sky, and that's the sun and moon, because it just, it makes it, since we know what the sun and moon actually are, like, do you guys think, does it make sense? I wish, because there's no science here at all. It's very mythological and magical, and it just took me out of it almost a little bit.
I think this is actually one of the things that he wishes he didn't write, but he couldn't think of a better way to do it.
Like, I don't think Tolkien wrote this. I think Tolkien probably specifically didn't write it. And
no, he did.
Oh, he did?
He did write this. Okay. I just remember the Tolkien professor talking about it.
All right.
And how he wishes he couldn't come up with a better way to do it, and he just decided, well, it's a fantasy world. But, you know, he didn't actually publish this, so maybe he would have changed it in the end.
Because, like, the moon eventually, you know, starts to chase the sun because it wants to be close to it, but it gets burned, so then they have to separate them and set them on separate paths, so basically they're only in the sky at the same time very rarely. So the sun and moon are finally starting. Morgoth hates the light of the sun, and he delves his fortress of Angband even deeper, and he sends up a great smoke above the mountains of Thangorodrim, which is another one of my favorite words from this, to block out the sun. And then Morgoth attacks the moon because he hates it, but he's unsuccessful. His spirits are beaten back by the moon and its servants.
Okay. Which right there makes me think that, you know, Balrogs, it doesn't specifically say it was Balrogs here, but they could have had wings because you can't get to the moon without some kind of flight.
They were his spirits, yeah. Well, we know they definitely have wings. It's just that they might be vestigial, right? Isn't that the debate? Or they're wreathed in shadow?
Because they say, like, it sends out its shadow as if wings or something like that. It's very convoluted, and people don't...
Yeah, but every illustration I've seen, they've all got wings.
And the one in the Lord of the Rings movies is awesome, so I don't see why we don't just call that
canon. Who's complaining?
So, that's why he sent them farther, right? Because they were attacked. The moon, that's why they sent them farther out, because...
See, I don't know if they were originally closer. I know that they separated them and they set them on, like, separate paths, but I didn't get... But I took it as Morgoth attacked them and was, you know, freaked out and scurried back, so I didn't know. But maybe they moved them a little higher up into the firmament.
The whole part of them, when they go under, is, like, very vague and nonsensical.
Well, there's nothing nonsensical about Olmo's people taking it and shuffling it under the disc world and then popping it up along the other side. There's nothing weird about that.
No. The Earth isn't round yet. Just get over it.
I know. Science.
Right. I mean, I think we had this conversation on the forums that it's just a pancake world before all worlds were bent.
Right. You just have to stop trying to fit it into what we know as science, and, you know, just keep
it. It's not a creation myth for Earth.
Right. Although, well, that's what he was trying to do, for England at least.
But he gave up, because he realized it's not.
But the constellations are all the same.
I think it's the Book of Lost Tales that actually has one of his earliest illustrations. Was he drew, like, a Viking longship, and he drew it as if that was the Earth, and there was the water underneath, and there was the sky was in the sail. It was really weird. I don't know if anyone else has seen that illustration. I think it's in the Book of Lost Tales, but it kind of is like, this is, that was his earliest thinking of the world was it was a ship. We also are told here that as Morgoth creates more evil things, or the more evil of himself that he puts into his creations, I don't think he becomes less powerful, but they say he's bound more to the earth the more he does. And I think this is why he never really changes his form after this, because ever since he does his exchange with Ungoliant, he never changes his form. He's always a dark lord, terrible to behold. Where when he was
burnt
going,
hands.
Yeah, with burnt hands.
Gonorrhea hands.
So the Valar, they know they're not ready yet to attack Morgoth and force, so they decide to fortify the land of Amon from any future attack from Morgoth. They raise the Pelori Mountains even higher. They make the cliffs sheer so no one can climb over them. They set a guard at the pass in the mountains. And they also set up the enchanted isles around Tol Eressëa, so anybody who's sailing to Valinor will become lost and crash upon these islands and then fall asleep and live there forever. Which seems kind of cruel, but I get what they're doing.
Is it explained how the elves, like in the Third Age, get there? Like, are they given a pass? Like, okay, you can come.
That all gets explained later when the world changes. Yeah, but it does end with this kind of cryptic passage.
Yeah, because right now the world is a pancake, right?
But we don't have to use such crude terms as pancake world when we're talking about the Silmarillion. But yes, it's a pancake.
No, it's more like a flapjack, hotcake,
regional.
It's like a waffle, really.
It's just flat.
All right. So it ends where they're saying that the doom of Mandos was fulfilled, where he said that the land of Amon would be shut against the Noldor. Thus it was that as Mandos foretold to them in Ahriman, the blessed realm was shut against the Noldor. And of the many messengers that in after days sailed into the west, none came ever to Valinor, save only one, the mightiest mariner of song. So it's another mention of someone who we're not going to meet for another 200 pages, but keep that in mind. It'll show up.
Sometimes I wonder why he even puts that in there. It's neat, but it's like, why'd you even mention that?
He's a troll.
Oh, no one ever came back until this one guy.
Just flip 200 pages.
Well, critical readers of Lord of the Rings will probably remember the 3-page song that is sung at some point. It might have been in Rivendell, I think, of Iarondel and his voyage. So maybe it's just he's trying to see who's paying attention.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, but that was made up by Bilbo Baggins, and he was a hobbit, and it's not an elf.
Yes, but he's obsessed with elf culture, and he loved getting access to the books.
And they talked about, I don't know if I heard about this somewhere, I guess. It was actually, this is the book that Bilbo read to make that, or something like that.
The Silmarillion?
Yeah, like, yeah. This is supposed to be that book.
He read it in what's it called?
Rivendell.
Yeah. I mean, he also got, obviously, probably some first-hand accounts, but they said, like, the book that he passes on to Bilbo was supposed to be the Silmarillion, or Frodo. Anyway, go ahead, sorry.
No, because they make a statement in that book that's like, oh, how can we tell between a hobbit and mortal, because all mortals are the same thing? I'm pretty sure Shellfish said something like, oh, yeah. Sheep between sheep.
No, like he gave Frodo like a book of elvish tales, and this is supposed to be that book, like hypothetically.
Right, but there's the other book, the Red Book of Westmarch, which is the book. That's a different book, then, right?
That's his own tale.
Right.
That's his tale.
But that's
right.
that he gives Frodo that book also that he's writing.
But he gave him another book of elvish tales, which was supposed to be this book in Tolkien's little. Yeah. Narrative.
Well, also, they reference 3 or 4 books in here, like, you know, as is told previously in the book of so-and-so, written by so-and-so, but that book's so famous that I'm not going to mention it here. You know, it's more of that, you know, and Bilbo's got access to these books now in Valinor, because he gets to go back to Valinor.
And Bilbo's dead.
No, Bilbo lives forever. Bilbo lives.
Oh, so, like, the world of Ice and Fire? Oh, no, sorry, like, they just reference a lot of other maesters.
Oh, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay, I get you now.
No spoilers.
I didn't want to spend too much on the different stages of the Sun and the Moon, but it's basically they got their stuff worked out, and now they work the way they work in our world.
Kinda, because not really. I don't know if you know this, Greg, but the Sun is like the center of our little solar system, and we actually pass around the Sun.
Blasphemy.
Propaganda.
But thus began the counting of days. Right.
Yes, the sun rise and fall each day. Mm-hmm.
So now we can say this day and this one night instead of this one time.
Yeah, that kind of blew my mind when I was reading it, because so everything that's happened before is kind of like the picture on the cover of my book, the second edition, is, I guess, the Eldar. Like, it looks like it's really early morning. It's like real, it's twilight. It's not bright at all. It's just the light from the stars and the light from the far-off tree. And there was no weeks or days. It was just all kind of happening.
Well, there was the short time that they had the two lamps where they kind of like mingle, but that was relatively short. But and that was before the elves were around. But yeah, it's been ever since the those were destroyed. Middle-earth was in twilight, but Valinor had the light of the trees.
Right. And they kind of like time passed according to the trees at that point. But then the trees died, and they're like, man, we need something else. Let's throw a fireball in the sky.
Arel Bereskli Thoniel, Sidivren Penamiriel o Menel Aglar Elenath, Nahaired Palandiriel o Galas Remmin Enorath, Fanuilos Lelinathon, Nevaya Si Nevayaron.
So now we come to our final chapter of Men, and Shane has agreed to do overtime for this one, and he'll be doing the recap.
Chapter 12 of Men. Yeah, when I agreed to do this, I said, this is two pages, but I forgot these were Tolkien pages. So,
just read the two pages.
More or less, but yeah. So the Valar chill out after giving light to Middle-earth. Morgoth is uncontested, save for the valor of the Noldor. But Olmo kept up on current events. I'm going to read the chapter here, or this passage. From this time forth were reckoned the years of the sun. Swifter and briefer are they than the long years of the trees in Valinor. In that time the air of Middle-earth became heavy with the breath of growth and mortality, and the changing and aging of all things was hastened exceedingly. Life teemed upon the soil and in the waters, and in the second spring of Arda, and the Eldar increased, and beneath the sun, Beleriand grew green and fair. So basically, this is when Middle-earth becomes the way it is, more or less, as we know it.
Yeah, like everything was on pause in the sleep of Yavanna up until this point, and now that the sun's up to wake up the, you know, the creatures and the trees, and now everything's like a regular world, I guess.
Yeah,
like Shane said last episode, green was created.
Let's go with that.
At the first rising of the sun, men awoke in Hildarion in the east. The sun rose in the west, because that's the way it started.
Yep.
And men moved toward it. The Eldar called men the Atani, or second people, and the Hildar, which means followers, and the Apananor, which means the afterborn, which is kind of gross. It sounds like afterbirth. The Ingmar.
God damn it.
I'm sure they go with the Apananor more than or the afterborn.
Yeah, Ingvar, which means sickly, Firimar, the mortals, and also they called them the usurpers, the strangers, the inscrutable, the self-cursed, the heavy-handed, the nightfarers, and the children of the sun.
Why are the elves such dicks? They have all these slang terms, like, right away. It's like, this is what we're going to call you now.
You, stunted people. You, sickly.
They're so mean.
Little is told of men here, except for the Anatanatari, who went north. No Valar came to guide men, so men feared them. It's kind of douchey on the Valar, right?
Well, they kind of fucked it up with the elves. Well, I guess you don't really know that yet.
Well, it's not up to the Valar. It's up to, right? Eru? Like, that's...
Well, it's just kind of shitty. They're like,
the second they're, coming.
They're like, second they're like the second kid, you know? You get no attention.
Elmo gives them some attention later on.
Yeah, he kept them in his thoughts, and he sent them messages. So they loved the sea, but they did not understand it, because they really didn't understand his messages. Men eventually hooked up with some dark elves, and they learned from them a lot of things.
And those aren't evil elves. They're just... Right. They're called elves.
Never went and knew the Valar. Never learned from the Valar. They've just been twiddling around on Middle-earth. The light of the sun kept Morgoth at bay in these times, because it was new and he feared it, and many works of Yavanna now bloomed and grew. Men spread west, north, and south. This time passed, and there came a time of war between Morgoth and the Sindar and Noldor and men. In those days, elves and men were of like stature and strength of body, but the elves had greater wisdom and skill and beauty, and those who had dwelt in Valinor and looked upon the powers as much surpassed the dark elves in these things as they in turn surpassed the people of mortal race.
So basically there's power levels. There's the elves that saw the tree that hung out with the Valar that are super powerful. And then there's the elves that hung out with Melian that are just a step below them. And then there's the dark elves that didn't see shit, just kind of figured out their own stuff. And then there's men.
There's a Thingol that held a with Melian that actually saw the trees.
The Noldor were greater than the Sindar. The Sindar were greater than men. And we get here contradictory information, which I'm going to read from here. Immortal were the elves, and their wisdom waxed from age to age, and no sickness or pestilence brought death to them. Their bodies, indeed, were of the stuff of earth, and could be destroyed, and in those days they were more like to the bodies of men, since they had not so long been inhabited by the fire of their spirit, which consumes them from within in the courses of time. But men were more frail, more easily slain by weapon or mischance, and less easily healed, subject to sickness and many ills, and they grew old and died. So it seems like that men and elves were very similar, but then they say at the same time that they're very different.
Well, that's why the whole pointy ear thing is like something that was made up to differentiate them, but we're pretty much it's spelled out for us that they look physically the same. They just they have different attributes, like
and the elves are more beautiful.
Yeah, because they've got the light of Ammon in their eyes and everything. I mean, if you saw an elf and a man, I don't know if you'd be able to tell them apart unless you said, "Hey, how old are you?" "Oh, I'm 20." You know, "How old are you?" "I'm 7,600 years old." "Oh, you're the elf."
Men's fate after death is unknown. Beren returned from the mansions of the dead, but he never spoke afterward to mortal men. Do we meet Beren yet, or are we going to meet Beren?
You're going to meet Beren.
Nah, you're going to meet okay. Beren.
It's another weird name drop of the things yet to come. And you get another big one in the next paragraph.
And then we are told how things will eventually be by the time, like, the Third Age. But then this time, men and elves are allies, and some men were great and valiant captains of the Noldor.
Hell yeah, they were.
Very briefly.
And in the glory and beauty of the elves, and in their fate, full share had the offspring of elf and mortal, Erendil and Elwing and Elrond their child. So Elrond is the child of Erendil and Elwing, is that what they're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, pretty much.
We don't know who they are yet.
And that's chapter 12 of Men. Glad the action's picking up.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of action going forward.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's why I feel that, you know, so many people are turned off by the whole build-up in the beginning and the creation, but once it does start, it really is. There's a lot going on. And once the Noldor get back and they're, you know, the war start, it's just tragedy after tragedy, but it's fun to read about.
The problem is time. Like, right now, time is flying by. Like, you just can't even comprehend how many years have gone by just in the time of the trees. And, like, as the book goes on,
they don't even
zoom
have
in.
Time.
Well, they have a measure of time, but we don't know. Because
like, they don't have time until the sun and moon come up, right?
Kind of. But, yeah, but they call them, like, Melkor was chained for three ages. Now, if that's true, then the third age, it's a different kind of ages, but the first, the second, and the third age happen after that.
Right.
The time that Melkor was chained is the same amount of time that everything else happens after the trees are destroyed. I still just can't believe how condescending the elves are.
Really?
They meet the dwarves and they just like immediately start picking on them, and then they meet the men and they immediately start picking on them, and they wonder why these people are cool toward them. I guess the men fall right in love with them, but the dwarves
but
are kind
of... Think of them, because... Like, if you met another being that wasn't immortal, that was weaker, you know, you would look down. I think you would look down. They think they're a different species. They're not their equals.
Well, they are a different species.
I know, but we don't, like, another thing. There's nothing comparable to, like, if all of a sudden ants started talking, yeah, and be like, "Hey, we're here, and we'd like to learn from you." You'd be like, "Ugh, get a little, I don't know." Maybe that was a bit.
And they are basically, like, God's chosen children. You know, they were taken to the land of the gods and taught by the gods. And these men are just on Middle Earth and are not taught anything, I mean.
Ooh, don't talk about chosen people.
What?
Well, I mean, it would seem that way to them.
Yeah, but...
Well, they're the firstborn, and you can't help but feel special. I mean, Feanor is the firstborn, and he feels special.
And the fact
but Feanor's a dick.
We know.
I mean, I think we've all assumed that.
Well, the fact that they have, like, a quasi-immortality is really what puts them on edge, like, gives them an edge over men and dwarves. I mean, a man and a dwarf can only do so much in their lifetimes, whereas elves can just, you'd think, could do a lot.
Yeah,
yeah, but at the same time, they grow tired. And that's their whole thing. Like, they grow tired of the earth.
And they dwindle.
Yeah.
All right.
Like this podcast, they dwindle.
Okay, we've got our end. All right, thank you everyone for joining us for our third one. Next week we will be getting into some divisions of Beleriand, and we'll be meeting some really pissy elves, and yeah, some more fun stuff will go down. But I hope you're enjoying it, and you can join us next time. All right.
Until next time.
Bye bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Is that her vagina?
I don't think so.
It's almost like, you know, how Yvanna was involved in the Silmarils, that the Olmo and the lesser
Ase
and Nath. No, what's the other one? what's there's the two of them?
The Ase, Olme, and
who's Olme? Tell me who's Olme.
No, was it Ase and Uinen?
Uinen, there we go. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Okay, yeah, they helped.
Oh, of course you were.
Is that her vagina?
I don't think so. Right, they all dwindle, but
dwindle the elf.
God damn it! Wasn't that your fucking like horror episode where Gwendolyn was a dwarf?
Wait, what? No, Brett mentioned how elves dwindle last episode, and I pictured a little elf named Dwindle, like Dwindle.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Oh, good.
It just seems like an elf name, not an elven name, like a little elf. Sorry to derail it. Continue.
Is that her vagina?
I don't think so.
This time passed over. This time. All right, I'm reading here. I was scribbling it fast when I was writing this.
No, Greg, does it frustrate you that you're the only one that can read out of the four of us?
Well, I have been reading these passages out loud for the last week to myself to make them sound so perfect, but no, it's fine.
Oh, so we're not prepared. Damn it.
Is that her vagina?
I don't think so. Man, I always feel like I write too much. I got like 2.5 pages.
It's tough.
I've got a page and a half on my 2-page of men chapter.
Well, you could just say men show up. That's
if it was a normal author, I could, but not with Tolkien.
Yeah.
It's weird because I want to make it like so every paragraph is like a sentence, and then I end up writing a paragraph for every paragraph.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got some passages to read in my summaries too. Some of it's like, there's no point in summarizing. I mean, it's like so great, but it's there on the page.
I know. I was taking notes at the bookstore. It was really slow, and I had this, and I was like taking notes. And someone came and was like, "Oh, are you taking a class?" I was like, "Do I just say yes as the simple answer and close the book?" But I decided to attempt to explain what we're doing. They're like, "Oh, that's cool. Now, can I please buy my Nora Roberts book?"